21147, Leander Mann versus United States of America. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Holt for appellant.
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Kelly Holt for petitioner appellant Leander Mann. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Within months of Leander Mann's federal conviction, the COVID-19 pandemic struck the United States. Beyond the major effects the pandemic had on everyone, and especially those within the prison system, the pandemic had two concrete and individualized effects on Mann personally. First, he suffered from a debilitating bout of COVID that persisted for a month in the spring of 2020. And second, when he was transferred from state to federal prison in the fall of 2020, he faced lengthy quarantines during which he was completely separated not only from other prisoners, but also from any resources for legal research and from his personal legal materials. He was only released from quarantine in October 2020, the month before his Section 2255 petition was due. Taken together, Mann's illness and his later quarantine prevented him from working on his habeas petition for approximately 2 months. Despite these challenges and the other major hurdles that Mann faced as a pro se litigant attempting to prepare a petition during COVID from prison, Mann filed his Section 2255 petition only 47 days late.
Now, Mr. Mann made some other petitions during that period, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. So in the summer of 2020, shortly after prison lockdowns were lifted for a brief period of time, Mann filed a brief compassionate release petition in which he detailed his own personal medical history and the reasons why he believed that he was uniquely at risk from acquiring COVID-19. After he filed that pro se petition, he was appointed counsel for the sole purpose of assisting with the compassionate release petition, and his counsel then made certain other filings during the remainder of the time period at issue. But the fact that Mann was able to file that compassionate release petition does nothing to suggest that he could or should have prepared his Section 2255 petition during that same time frame.
Why doesn't it? I mean, they're both legal petitions.
Certainly they are both legal petitions, but they're very different in the nature of what's required to prepare them. The compassionate release petition took very little legal research, and the risk of filing a compassionate release petition is relatively low because there's not the same harsh consequences that there might be from filing a Section 2255 petition, whereby he might forfeit a claim if he fails to include a good claim in his initial Section 2255 petition. So Mr. Mann, in order to file the compassionate release petition, really only needed to know his own medical history. That's really the only thing that's reflected in the pro se petition that he filed, is that he had certain health conditions that put him at particular risk. In order to prepare his habeas petition, he needed to actually do legal research, ascertain what the grounds for a habeas petition might be, work through the record of his own conviction, and determine which of those grounds might be appropriate to raise in a habeas petition. And all of that takes legal research. It takes time. And in the summer of 2020, Mann likely believed, as many of us did, that the pandemic would continue to improve and that he would have better access to legal resources as the remainder of his limitations period went on. But in fact, for Mann, things only got worse in the fall of 2020.
In your brief, you argue that about two months, give or take, is kind of the period that he was significantly incapacitated such that he couldn't file. I mean, what is the amount of time? If he was sick for 1 day, does he get 1 day tolling?
Your Honor, I think this is a matter of equity, so there are no bright line rules here that there's a certain amount of time that has to.
What is that? Apply. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, okay, he's sick for 2 months at the beginning of the period. What do you get? I mean, does he get 2 months extra, or is it 10 months enough?
I think it would depend on the facts of the individual case.
Why is that? That seems to create a lot of problems for everyone, including prisoners, who don't have a bright line in that circumstance.
That's the nature of equitable tolling, is that it has to be performed on a case-by-case basis. And that's
so is 10 months enough?
10 months could be enough under certain circumstances.
With a habeas petition, 10 months enough.
10 months could be enough for a habeas petition under certain circumstances, depending on whether the remainder of the time that the petitioner actually had was relatively unencumbered, what the resources that the petitioner had available to him. What this court has repeatedly emphasized is that the time that the person is incapacitated or the extraordinary circumstances that they face have to be considered in context with what else they face and the realities of their environment. So sometimes the extraordinary circumstances that prevent themselves might not be enough on their own to justify equitable tolling, but when combined with other realities of that particular petitioner's situation, they become enough to make it that the petitioner did not have a fair opportunity to present his claims.
As to diligence, why can't we consider the fact that he filed other things, as Judge Bush mentioned? I get the difference in complexities, but why can't we consider that? Why couldn't I get that you need to list everything, but he could list it in a bare-bones fashion at any time and say, I seek permission to file an amended petition.
So first, Your Honor, you certainly can consider the fact that he filed other things during that time, and it's our position that, in fact, the fact that he was pursuing other avenues for relief from his sentence throughout that time shows that he was being diligent.
But really, so a serial filer we would give more credit to than someone else?
Someone who was filing repeated things with the court attempting to challenge his position, his sentence, even if it might not be the right form, I think that petitioner would get more credit than someone else, that they were being diligent and that they were acting in a way to protect their rights. Because the question here is whether the petitioner was sleeping on their rights or whether they were acting with reasonable diligence given their circumstances. So if Mr. Mann was informed of the ability to file a compassionate release petition and informed of the fact that that might be a more immediate route to relief in the summer of 2020, particularly given his concerns that, in fact, he could get COVID again, and he had already experienced it once in a particularly debilitating manner, and it could become even more deadly for him, as he suggested in his compassionate release petition, that pursuing that avenue for relief does not suggest that he was sleeping on his rights. To the contrary, it suggests that he was being diligent and was attempting to make the most of his time and to do what he could to seek relief.
Is our standard of review de novo for all of this?
Your Honor, the standard of review is de novo to the extent the facts are undisputed and is an abuse of discretion as far as disputed facts. In this case, the government's position is that the material facts are undisputed. So it is undisputed that Mann was completely incapacitated by his illness for a month. It's undisputed that he was quarantined for a period of approximately 24 days, during which he had no access to any legal resources or to the other prisoners even to discuss the case. So those facts are all undisputed, and this court thus can look de novo at the district court's decision.
So you've got the magistrate saying there should be equitable tolling, and then the district court said there should not be. Is that what happened here?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what happened here. So the magistrate judge raised the question of equitable tolling based on a liberal reading of Mann's pro se pleadings. It's clear that Mann did not understand that equitable tolling was the relevant doctrine. When he responded to the government's motion to dismiss, he seemed to be referencing statutory tolling instead, but given the equitable considerations that he raised, the magistrate judge appropriately, liberally interpreted that to raise the question of equitable tolling and suggested it should be granted. The government's response to that was not, no, there should be no equitable tolling here. The government's response was, the current record is insufficient to decide whether or not there should be equitable tolling because the circumstances that Mann has pointed out may well have prevented him from timely filing his petition and that we need more evidence here. But rather than taking more evidence, the district court instead denied Mann equitable tolling. So at a minimum, to the extent the court finds that the current record is insufficient, as the government suggested below, the court should remand for more fact-finding in order to answer any unresolved questions that there might be in the record.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, because you're saying it's de novo and the government's acknowledged everything, and now you're saying there may be some facts that are in dispute.
The material facts with respect to the fact that Mann faced extraordinary circumstances and the facts that he did perform certain diligent acts are undisputed. The government suggests that there are basically holes in the record that could be filled in by Mann potentially, and the government below suggested the appropriate course would be to allow for more fact-finding. On appeal, they've taken the position that instead Mann should simply be denied equitable tolling because of the holes that were created in the record when he was operating as a pro se petitioner who didn't understand what arguments he was even trying to make. If your honors have no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
All right, Ms. Curry.
May it please the court, Jessica Curry for the United States. This court should affirm because Mann does not present the rare case in which equitable tolling should be invoked. Both Holland requirements set a high bar, and affirmance is proper here if Mann falls short on either one.
Are you arguing that there should be any further fact-finding, or are you accepting all the facts as alleged by Mann?
We accept the facts. Our position is that the facts are undisputed, but that they don't create a question of fact that would necessitate an evidentiary hearing. As for the first requirement, Mann cannot show that an extraordinary circumstance actually prevented timely filing. The causation requirement is firmly established, yet Mann's main theory is an attempt to sidestep causation. As Mann sees it, the period when he was ill and in quarantine become banked time that can simply be tacked on the end of the limitations period.
But is he really saying that? It seems to me he's saying, look, there's a lot of things that when put together did not give me sufficient time to file what is a complex motion in a timely fashion.
I think that's part of his argument, but his argument was also that it took almost 2 months for me to deal with these impediments, and therefore equity should allow for at least that much time. Mann even doubled down on that approach in the reply brief. So to the extent this court interprets it in that way, it should reject a theory of banked time. Rather than simply bank the time, this court should instead look to the context and overall timeline in which these two impediments occurred. Here, Mann's one-month illness occurred early on, leaving 7 months of time on the clock. The 3 weeks of quarantine occurred later, but still left 7 weeks on the clock. And overall, there was 10-plus months of unimpeded time.
But he says he didn't have law library access then. He was transferred. Like, he had a lot of things going on that prevented him from doing the research necessary to file the petition. Why can't we consider that?
So one qualification on that, for the 10 months of unimpeded time, he doesn't allege any transfers. The only thing he alleges there is the restrictions on library access. Our law is...
What were the 8 and 16-day periods? I can't remember that he mentioned.
He was transferred to another facility that resulted in him being in quarantine for 8 days, and then there was an additional 16 days when he's at the federal institution at Milan, where due to COVID, because he had traveled, he was quarantined for an additional 16 days.
So those transfers did affect the time he had access to the law library.
I agree, yes.
Okay.
That part isn't disputed.
Anything in the record as to how much time he had access to the law library?
Not specifically. What we have are his allegations that during certain periods of time there were restrictions. Late January or early February up until mid-July. He does not allege that those were, in all cases, a total ban on library access. There were limitations. He does not allege any restrictions to the library for the last 4 months of the limitations period. Having an abundance of unimpeded time lessens the impact of those restrictions. And in any event, those types of restrictions under this court's law are not extraordinary anyway. If that weren't enough, this case is made easier because the record refutes causation for two reasons, the first being the compassionate release filings and the other being Mann's admitted mistake about the deadline.
So can I ask you about the compassionate release filing? Because your friend on the other side says, look, the compassionate release filing demonstrates diligence. It's just easier for a prisoner to file, which I think is pretty undisputed, than a habeas petition would be.
I disagree on the fact that it would necessarily be easier. The petition that Mann filed was 20 pages. It included a legal analysis, citations to authority, and this was a relatively new area of law, compassionate release. So I disagree that it was as straightforward as Mann suggests, but the fact that there are different factual or legal inquiries involved is beside the point for purposes of causation. The point is that Mann was perfectly capable of preparing a lengthy and complex filing, and that is incompatible with his position that the COVID-related barriers actually caused his untimely filing. In any event, Mann did not spend all of his unimpeded time seeking compassionate release. There were 3 months before the pandemic hit. There were almost 2 months after he filed his compassionate release motion in July 2020. Once it was filed, he was then freed up to work on his habeas petition, and then there were also 7 weeks post-quarantine. In addition, Mann was admittedly mistaken about the filing deadline. When he first responded to the government's motion to dismiss, Mann said he believed that the pandemic, quote, quite naturally suspended his deadline. It doesn't matter if someone told him that the deadline was suspended or if he assumed that on his own. There is no dispute that his understanding was incorrect, and a mistake or ignorance about a deadline is not extraordinary. This court has said that as recently as Falkowski in 2022. In addition, his subsequent declaration, it did focus on other facts, but he never walked away from his original excuse that he was mistaken about the deadline. As for the second requirement, Mann cannot show diligence throughout the limitations period. Indeed, he does not allege any work on his habeas petition during the 10-plus months of unimpeded time, not even a single trip to the library. Again, there was 3-plus months before the pandemic, 5-plus months post-illness, and 7 weeks post-quarantine. The only affirmative effort he points to is requesting his legal materials while in quarantine. That may show diligence for 3 weeks while he was in quarantine, but it says nothing about the 10-plus months of unimpeded time. For all we know, he maybe did not begin his habeas petition until after the time had already run out, and after all, his belief was that he had more time. Mann has argued that simply having the materials to request shows that he must have been working on his habeas petition. That's not a fair inference. Your case file includes legal materials. Old pleadings include legal materials. His compassionate release documents are legal materials, and of course we know that he had those. Mann has also argued that the compassionate release requests are themselves evidence of diligence. But for prisoners seeking tolling of a habeas-specific deadline, it only makes sense that the diligence must also be habeas-specific. This court, in cases following Holland, support the view that diligence must be habeas-specific. In Jones, the defendant was delayed in learning of a Supreme Court case that gave rise to his habeas claim. And this court stated, Jones was diligent in pursuing new claims, and this claim in particular, which was a clear reference to his habeas-specific efforts. In addition, this court can consider that the habeas petition on its face took little time to prepare. It's a 6-page document. Most of it is procedural, and the 4 grounds for relief are simply repackaged arguments that had already been raised and rejected. I do appreciate that a petitioner needs to vet other possibilities, perhaps rule those out because this habeas petition is his one shot, but here he had more than 10 months in order to do that. Congress set the 1-year deadline for all prisoners. That includes prisoners in capital cases. It includes prisoners whose trial extended many months. In this case, there was no trial. This case ended in a guilty plea. There are only so many options for a defendant to then challenge his conviction. So under those circumstances, certainly 10-plus months of unimpeded time was a sufficient amount of time for this court, for Mann to have vetted any other possible arguments. An evidentiary hearing is also not required. The allegations, even accepted as true, don't show anything approaching reasonable diligence, and the record refutes the causation requirement. The government's arguments aren't conclusory. They are based on the factual record, as the district court properly reasoned. Unless the court has further questions, the government respectfully asks that this court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to respond first to the government's suggestion that Mr. Mann is arguing for a banked time theory of equitable tolling, that having been impeded for a certain period of time, that time is just automatically tacked onto the back end. That has never been Mr. Mann's argument. The argument is that the fact that the amount of time that he was impeded is more than the time that he was delayed at least suggests that causation is possible and that reasonable diligence is possible. It's not that there's an automatic addition of time at the end. It's just that that's a useful landmark to show whether causation is even possible. So in this court's cases, for example, and other courts, where the amount of time that was impeded time, where there were extraordinary circumstances, is less than the amount of time than the delay, that shows that there was no causation. But
I have one question about the mistake. So the mistake that the court was closed for 90 days, is that a mistake of law or a mistake of fact?
Your Honor,
on his behalf.
Your Honor, I think it's arguably both a mistake of law and a mistake of fact. I think he was confused about the factual circumstances and also about the legal implications of those facts. I think in either event, the government emphasizes that that's not an extraordinary circumstance on its own, and Mann agrees. The mistake on its own would not be an extraordinary circumstance that would entitle him to equitable tolling, but it's certainly relevant to whether he was reasonably diligent, and it shouldn't count against him that he had that confusion about what the timeline was. And it's certainly contrary to the government's position.
I mean, he had an attorney at the time. He could have asked if he was confused.
Your Honor, it's very possible that he did ask if he was confused, and his attorney, who was appointed for a very limited purpose of assisting
with his confession release. But he filed a statement here. He didn't say anything about that. You would think he would say that. In his declaration, he says nothing about that, right?
Your Honor, it's correct that he does not say exactly why he believed that the deadline had been told for 90 days. It is my understanding that if there were an evidentiary hearing, he would be able to provide more information about why he believed that that deadline had been told.
Sure, but he didn't provide any context, did he?
He in his declaration, he did not, because in his papers, when he filed them, it seems he continued to believe that that was true. So he didn't think that he needed to explain the basis for that belief at the time that he filed his response. So the mistake on its own is at least relevant to what is reasonable. And any questions about whether Mr. Mann simply assumed that or was told that or what his, the basis for that belief was would only go to show that there should be an evidentiary hearing here at a minimum. I think it's also notable that my colleague referenced the fact that, quote unquote, for all we know, Mr. Mann didn't start working on his petition until sometime near the time of his quarantine. If that's true, if that's simply speculation about whether he was working on it or not, that's a reason for an evidentiary
hearing.
The burden's
on him, right? The burden's not on the government. And so he's got an opportunity with his declaration and elsewhere to show all the circumstances. And he could have said, I worked on it throughout, but here are the materials I couldn't get, and here's why I was prevented.
Your Honor, so he does specifically say, not in his declaration, but in his briefing, and again, he's a pro se litigant, so it's not clear whether he really understood the difference between these things, but he does say that he acted as diligently as he could throughout the time period in his response.
Sure, but he doesn't give any details of that.
He doesn't give any details, but this court has not required that a pro se petitioner operating under these circumstances has to provide that level of detail in order to at least get an evidentiary hearing. What this court has held in Atta v. Scutt, actually, was that a petitioner who made basically an identical statement that he had acted as diligently as he could, given his circumstances, had done enough on that prong in order to get an evidentiary hearing when he had also specifically identified the extraordinary circumstances that he had faced, which is what Mann has done here. He has articulated the specific circumstances that he faced that were extraordinary, that prevented him from working on his petition, and that are actually undisputed. So the remaining questions about what level of diligence actually looked like throughout the time period, those are at most questions for an evidentiary hearing. They're not a reason to deny equitable tolling to Mr. Mann. The other point that I wanted to respond to is just the repeated use of the phrase unimpeded time in reference to Mr. Mann's circumstances is just incorrect. There were not 10 plus months of unimpeded time. I think it's undisputed that for at least the bulk of 2020, there were significant restrictions, not only on Mr. Mann's access to prison libraries, but also on his ability to confer with other inmates, to use any other resources that might ordinarily be available to a prisoner in order to learn of legal developments.
Do you know how much time he had, from the record, access to the library?
The record is not clear. As the government said, he regained access to the library sometime in the summer of 2020, exactly what the restrictions looked like and what his access looked like during the remainder of the time, it's unclear from the record, unfortunately.
Your time is up. And
thank you.
We appreciate the argument both of you have given. And Ms. Holt, we particularly appreciate Jones Day having accepted this case pro bono, and appreciate your pro bono argument here today. Thank you both.